not your life. Number four, sometimes even your family needs the long-handled spoon. Look, I love my family. I am blessed to have them in my life. But we all know that sometimes when you love someone so deeply, they can hurt you or distract you without meaning to. So now and then, you have to treat people with the long-handled spoon. It's an old phrase that means that every once in a while, you need to keep your distance a little. I know a lot of people have small mother-daughter conflicts. And of course, I'm no different. Evelina and I are human. She can be my hero and still be human. For a long time, I think she feared that I would become full of myself. She worried that success would make me arrogant or forget to thank the Lord for the blessings he's giving me. To keep me humble, she didn't celebrate my achievements in high school. When my team won the city championship, she wasn't even there. My dad cheered double on her behalf. I resented it for a long time. When my career was really getting super hot, she went through a phase of saying, "Don't be getting on that high horse." Well, I kind of earned that high horse. I was proud to be up there, and I wanted to extend my hand to bring her up there with me, and I felt she batted it away. I would ask her if she saw something of mine on TV, and she would offer a vague, "If you don't call me and tell me it's on." I just wanted her to say she saw it, and I was pretty. Or I would send her clothing from a shopping spree because she wouldn't go shop for herself. "Mom, did you get the outfits I sent?" "Yeah, I got them, but some of them things, I don't know." She didn't know then that what I craved so much all my life, really, was simply her approval. A few years back, I learned to stop looking for that from her. If she said she was proud of me, it was because she truly was, not because I badgered it out of her. The long handle of the spoon gave me perspective. Our relationship improved. The long-handled spoon goes both ways, mind you. Sometimes you have to step back and say, "You know, I'm not going to tell you how to live your life." My dad and I are incredibly close. He sees everything I do. And he tells me all the time how proud he is to be my father. "That's my baby," he says. "I watched you. You're looking good." His health is not great as I've been writing this book. I visited him because I was concerned that he was becoming isolated with his wife. He wasn't reaching out to us Fox kids. But when I saw how much he depended on her, truly wanted her to be at his side in a time of crisis, I realized I had to respect that. I selfishly wanted to be the one to help him. And if it couldn't be me, then I felt damn sure it should have been a Fox kid. I had to get over it and show how much I love him by respecting whom he loves. Step back and examine your family relationships. If expecting them to change isn't working, try changing your expectations. Number five, be woman enough to apologize. I am the first to admit I am not perfect. I once had to ask for the forgiveness of two friends who I had flat-out wronged. It happened when I got caught up in the dreaded best friend contest. It's when your girlfriends fight over who is closer to you. As a celebrity, I am completely vulnerable to it, but then I did it myself. At the time, my girlfriend Aja was starting this thing with a weight loss company just as she had gotten a new boyfriend. She was super busy with both all the time, and I insecurely felt like I was losing her. I complained about it to my dear friend Jasmine, who sympathized. Then one night, maybe after a glass of wine, okay, definitely after a glass of wine, I went on Instagram and saw a picture of them together. Aja wrote, "My new client." I got into my feelings. I had it in my full head that Jasmine was somehow cheating on me by helping with the business. I wrote a scathing email, a truly ugly letter, talking about how I had connected them in the first place and asking them why they were going behind my back. I have to own that regret. And I got what I deserved. They didn't speak to me for a full year. I continually apologized, and the response was, "Nope, not accepted." When I lost that friendship, I made a promise to myself that if I ever find myself feeling a certain kind of way about a friend, I would say, "Hey, Let's talk about this. This is how you're making me feel. Because there's two sides to every story. Maybe it wasn't that person's intention to make you feel that way or to hurt your feelings. And maybe that day you were hypersensitive and didn't have the right perspective. They finally accepted my apology, and I accepted the lesson that came with saying I was wrong. I just didn't understand that new chapter for Aja. Now, she's engaged, and I love her fiancé. They're going to have a wonderful life together. But I made it about me losing her. I was too in her business. You've got to let your friends grow. Never say my way or the highway, because that doesn't make you a good friend. Part 3, A Troubleshooting Guide to the Heart. Lesson 9, If You Chase That Wedding Ring, You're Gonna Trip. Here's a really bad reason to get married, because everyone else is doing it. I know that's why I did it. It seems like a blink and you missed it marriage to a lot of people now. But in 1998, I went into a 4-year union that I had no business going into. I got married out of peer pressure and because I thought that was the next thing on the checklist of what it means to be a successful woman. I didn't take the time to get to know him. Let me take you back to December 19, 1996. I had just wrapped Soul Food, which was shot primarily in Chicago, and I was so happy to be back in warm, beautiful Los Angeles. My girls wanted to go out to celebrate my homecoming, so we headed to Bar One Nightclub in Beverly Hills. The girls and me were hanging and catching up on various storylines of each other's lives when the 6'9" guy comes up to us. "Are you Vivica Fox?" "Yeah," I said. "Wow," he said. "You're even better looking in person." Oh, vanity. I fell for it. But I'm a girl's girl, and I didn't want a guy to get in the way of a ladies' night. "You're a warm brother," I said, "but I have to go." I took the girls out onto the dance floor like we had an important meeting or I was Cinderella. As I was dancing, I sneak looks. He kind of stood out with that height. And the guy wasn't budging. My friends wanted to get drinks. So I went to the bar, intentionally not looking his way. He left and I thought, "Fool, you played yourself playing hard to get." But he came back. He bought 20 roses from one of those flower guys who hang outside the club. Some other guys started trying to talk to me, but he hung in, just handed me these 20 roses one by one. It had been so long since I had been wooed, it worked. I let him move into my house 4 months later. I was truly in love. He proposed 1 year to the day we met, December 19. I had been chasing that ring, honey, and I expected it for sure. The night of the proposal, he took me out to dinner, and oh, the meal was the worst. The whole time at the restaurant, there was me expecting him to take a knee at any moment. Every time a waiter brought a glass or a dish, I'd look for a ring. By the time we got to the car, I had gone through all the stages of grief in my head: denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. "Oh, well," I thought as I looked at my reflection in the passenger window, "maybe I'm expecting too much." We got home. I saw the place was filled with roses and candles. He asked my assistant to decorate the house with roses and scented candles while we were out to dinner. He got down on one knee and presented the ring. I was crying so much that I had to blink my eyes at the ring in the candlelight. I couldn't see straight. "What color is it?" I yelled, squinting. "You know I don't like gold." He laughed. "Thank God. It's platinum," he said. "Your favorite." I checked the box marked get an engagement ring on my list of life goals. Then I got started on the next to-do I thought I was supposed to fulfill: plan a dream wedding that wows everyone. We had our wedding exactly 1 year later, keeping our devotion to good old December 19th. I had it at the Park Plaza in Los Angeles, an art deco palace used as a film set for old Hollywood-type movies and as a venue by brides who won an over-the-top Cinderella wedding. Guilty as charged. I really went for it. I even arrived in a horse-drawn carriage decorated with flowers and white organza and sparkling little lights. A paparazzi photographer falling out of a tree delayed my big entrance. Someone freaked out and called an ambulance, but he was okay. We invited 260 people, including Madam King, the woman who put me in my very first fashion show. She was the biggest celebrity in my heart, but we also had Magic Johnson and Shaq, as well as my girls Holly Robinson Pete, Lila Rashan, and Tisha Campbell Martin. I wore an ivory escada gown that I kept sleek because I was terrified of looking like a poofy debutante. I wore my hair upswept, and you know I had the veil and crown. I also had my six bridesmaids in escada. But I gave them Reebok sneakers with silver trim to change into for the reception. I needed no excuses for why they couldn't be on the dance floor with me. Jeffrey Johnson, one of my boys from Arlington High School, had become a pastor, so he married us. My mom loved that. Tisha serenaded us with "The First Time Ever I Saw Your Face," and Tashina Arnold sang the Lord's Prayer a cappella. During dinner, we had the slideshow of pictures of us, separate from age 3, moving up until we were a couple. I looked at the face of little Angie growing up into Vivica, and I was so proud. I caught Madam King's eye, and she said, "Look at you." At the reception, my husband serenaded me with the song, "The Love You Give," which talks about roses. Then they pulled back a curtain, and there were two giant vases of 1,000 long-stem roses. I checked the box that said, "Perfect Wedding." Then real life began. I was miserable. I hate to say it, but I was just miserable. After the first year, I knew I had made a mistake. But I stayed. And that huge house began to feel like a big old prison that I built for myself. My husband was very comfortable watching me work and be the breadwinner and didn't seem to have any idea about our finances. Money was just there. Now, don't get it twisted. If you're blessed that your significant other makes real money, that's awesome. But in a true partnership, each has to contribute in some way. Otherwise, you are inviting resentment to just come into your life and make itself comfortable. Resentment will work its way into every little interaction you have with your partner. That's what happened to me. The first time I tried to talk about it, I had let that resentment back up, so it came out fast and furious. It happened when my husband and I were picking out an outfit for him to wear to a premiere we were attending. At the store, he announced that he needed a new pair of black shoes. "You've got 3 pairs of black shoes at home," I said. "But I want some new ones," he said. I nodded my head, and I remember saying to him so that no one could hear us, "I'm getting real sick of breaking out my credit card all the time." He paused and shook his head. "Damn," he said, "it hurts me just as much as it hurts you." Even then, I thought, what the hell? I have to pay for your shoes, your food, and the house? But we can't simply acknowledge that fact because your ego is fragile? I heard my mother's voice in my head. "Angie, I didn't raise you to take care of a man." I knew I would only resent my husband more if I wasn't honest with him. At home, I set him down, and I told him that I needed help carrying the load. He talked about getting out there to hustle for work and budgeting more. I thought, okay, we can go from here. But it only lasted a little while, and soon he was back to his habits. It became a cycle, with me asking for help from him and him trying for a short while. That resentment built up to a point where there was simply no room for love. When being honest with him didn't create change, I had to be honest with myself. We were living in a house with 5 bedrooms and 8 bathrooms. Our overhead was $12,000 a month. In the last year of our marriage, I was training for Kill Bill without getting paid. Had about $200,000 in the bank, and I just watched it whittle down while he didn't seem to notice. He was not concerned at all. There was an exact moment when I made a decision. It was after driving home after a long day of Kill Bill training. I walked into my house, completely sore and drained. The TV was on. I stood in the doorway. The words I said silently to myself and God were, "Lord, I don't want to do this no more." I had fallen out of love with him, and I grieved that. But I don't believe in living miserably. I talked to my assistant, Darren, who always knows just what to say. "I'm not happy," I said. I think I needed someone to tell me it was okay to leave him. And he saw right through that. "You decide what you're gonna do," he said. "It's gonna be on you." Darren was right, of course. My husband was not about to end this, so it was on me to do it. Soon after, I got a letter from a real estate agent saying that there was a lot of interest in my house. The community around me had built up on a hill, and my home had the most spectacular view. The letter said, "If I ever wanted to sell..." Darren was there when I got the letter. "Darren," I screamed, "there is a God, and he is good!" I put the place on the market, and just as soon as I did, Quentin Tarantino dropped the bomb on us that we all had to go to China to continue our martial arts studies. Initially, it was just going to be Uma Thurman going, but now we all had to go. I admit, I was really put out about it. So, after a horrific number of hours in the air, I landed in China at the crack of dawn, exhausted. Just as I had fallen asleep in my hotel room, the phone started going. Lord. It was Darren. "Darren, you know I have been freaking traveling forever," I said. "What?" "I got somebody sitting right here in your house," he said, "and she wants to buy it." "Let me tell you something," I said. "If you're bullshitting with me right now, I'm gonna kick your ass." "No, Viv," he said, speaking in a calm, pleasant voice that did not let the buyer know for one second that he was talking to a sleep-deprived lunatic. "She's about to go to the bank and make a down payment." I said, right up in that bed. "Sold," I said. "Sold." When I got back from China, I wanted to end things with my husband as swiftly and as amicably as possible. I told him I had set up a fully furnished apartment and paid the rent for a year. I also put $50,000 in the bank for him, and I was done. I didn't hate the guy. I just didn't want to be his wife anymore. When I left that house, it was like escape from Alcatraz. I got a giant U-Haul, and a bunch of my friends came over and helped me pack up my stuff. When the house was empty, we stood together, and they pledged that they would see me through this change. Then a couple too many of us squeezed into the front of the U-Haul. I was at the wheel, trying to be strong and keep it light for everyone. But I just started crying. I was taking these huge gulps of air, and one of my friends touched my arm saying, "Oh, baby." And probably thinking, "Oh, baby, don't you drive us off this here road and get us killed." When I could speak, I said, "I'm free. I am so grateful for their love and support." I made a huge profit selling that house, and I was grown up enough not to need another giant house to show people or me that I was a success. "See there," I said to myself as we drove, "you buckled down and you figured it out. You let go." Since then, I've sold 4 houses, and I'm so proud of how well I've done. Real estate has been very good to me, and I highly recommend it as an investment. It's a cliche, but it's true. Let your money work for you, not against you. Looking back, I have to take responsibility for this. When I let him move in after 4 months, I started a sprint to win that ring. Once I was engaged, I got wrapped up in planning that wedding. I see young girls still doing this today, but I think it's changing. I love watching them graduating, getting their degrees, and pursuing their dreams. I get asked if I have any marriage advice for young women. The first thing I tell them is to get a prenup. I had one, thankfully. Of course, I think there is nothing wrong with having a bank account with your spouse. But do me a favor and keep a little bank account on the side, just in case he or she gets a little crazy. It happens. You can say, "Okay, you can lose your damn mind by yourself, because I love me some me." But the main thing is take your time and get to know your partner and yourself before you rush into making a commitment before God and the IRS. And don't hold on to stuff too tightly that you squeeze the fun out of it. In life, I travel a lot lighter now. I recently finished a project and realized I had 6 days to myself. When I have that time, it means I declutter. It's not just that I'm a neat freak. I am. But I just don't want to hold on to stuff that can mean more to someone else. Goodwill does very well when I get in a purge mode. And I also resell my expensive designer clothes on eBay and through The RealReal, an online luxury consignment shop. And there are few things I like more than calling some girlfriends and saying, Vivica's garage sale is open. Take what you want. Do you have some purging to do? Think for a moment about your skinny clothes, the ones taking up room in your closet or in your drawer. Each day you see them, and each day they're taking up space. Let them go. Sell them online or at a consignment shop. Give them to the needy and the skinny because they are just getting in your way. Don't hold on to stuff that isn't working, whether it's a house you can't afford or a relationship you shouldn't invest any more time in. I promise you, if something you thought would make you happy has become a burden, you're better off letting it go. Sometimes you'll make a profit, and sometimes you'll just cut your losses, but you'll be free. Lesson 10. The devil is fine, and that's how he gets you. For years, I took the high road with him. In my own twisted way, I was being true to the man I knew Curtis wanted to be. I actually had no intention of even mentioning his name here. When I talked about this book with my publisher, he didn't even come up. I guess I was afraid that if I mentioned him, he would take credit for this too. He'd say I sold a book on his name. Yet, when Curtis has been on TV in his 50-cent role, he has made up stories about me and repeated them and got a reaction. I see the comments his followers leave on my Instagram sometimes. I admit, I can't help but click on their profiles, and they're usually about 16 with as many followers. Little boys who probably got their feelings hurt by a girl. I keep getting dragged on back like it's Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doomed Love. Well then, let me put on my archaeologist hat and go back in to end this foolishness once and for all so we all can move on. Because there might be a lesson in there for you. I know there was one for me. Who's 50 Cent? It was early 2003, and I was sitting with one of my girlfriends, Kim Stacy Carter. Kim was reading a magazine and had just told me, "You should date this guy, 50 Cent. She turned the magazine my way to show me the review of his Get Rich or Die Trying. The album cover had him shirtless, wearing a Louis Vuitton patterned gun holster. "Ooh, he's hot," she said. "Ew, why you got all that grease on him?" I asked. "To show off all the muscles." "Not my type," I said. His song, In the Club, was everywhere, so I kept hearing his name. But I swear, he wasn't on my radar at all that spring. In June, I was invited to the BET Awards, and I wore a short purple dress with a low cut and coral accents. Yes, I had my Kill Bill body, and I wanted to show it off. The photographers kept asking me for more photos on the carpet, just saying. So by the time I got into the theater, the show was beginning. And there was that 50 Cent guy on stage opening the show. I'd brought my makeup artist friend Tysla, and we were kind of cutting through the audience to get to our seats. As a fellow performer, I worried that this appeared rude, so I turned my head to look at him directly as I sidled to my seat. And he stopped. It was at this moment where he got stuck. His boy on stage had to tap him like, "Come on!" And he went right back into his performance. Tysel and I sat down to watch him, but it felt like he was watching me. "Does it feel like he's looking at me?" I murmured to Tysla through a closed smile. Yeah, she said. Later, when he went back on stage to accept the Best New Artist Award, he leaned on the podium and looked right at me. And I want to thank Vivica Fox for wearing that dress. The camera panned to me and my look of shock. Well, I was shocked. I was there minding my own business. But yes, I was flattered. I just didn't know what I was about to get into. After that public display of flirting, I didn't hear a single word from him until a month later. It was around my 39th birthday in July, and a van rolled up to my house. Two men came to the door, each holding a huge bouquet of lilies. They were my favorite, white Casablanca lilies. "We have a flower delivery for Vivica Fox," one said. "Come on in," I said. I started to talk about where they should put the flowers in my living room when one delivery guy politely stopped me. "Ma'am," he said, "there's a lot more." "It's the whole van," said the other guy. In and out they went until the house looked like a florist shop. Everywhere I looked, there were white petals with dots of these gorgeous red stamens. "Who sent them?" I asked. "We're not supposed to say, ma'am." Finally, they were done, and I tipped them for their marathon delivery. Not 5 minutes after they left, my girlfriend, Terry Cristiano's phone rang. She said, "50 Cent would like to speak to you." "Okay," I said. There was a pause, and then a bashful, thick-tongued voice came on the line. "Happy birthday," he said. "Thank you. Do you like the flowers?" "This was you?" I screamed. "Oh, my God, they're gorgeous. They're my favorite." "I know," he said. "How?" I asked around. I later found out that he had his assistant reach out to Terry. While I was talking to Curtis, I leaned back on my white couch, bobbing my knee up and down like I was back in Indiana on the phone with a boy. "Listen, where are you?" I asked. "On tour." "Oh, okay," I said. "Well, let me give you my private number so next time you can just call me." "Sure. And what do I call you?" "Just call me Curtis." For the next month, Curtis and I were always on the phone while he was on tour. The calls started kind of slow, and then it was morning, noon, and always before he went to sleep. Sometimes he would be talking to me just as he was about to perform. I could hear a tech say, "All right, come to stage," and then I could actually hear the audience scream. "Okay, baby," he'd say, "I'll call you after the show." Especially those times. Hearing the crowd cheer, I was amazed. He is a rock star. 50 Cent was blowing up, and Curtis was taking the time to share it with me. Our conversations would usually go for an hour, sometimes longer. He was very proud of his son, Marquise, from a previous relationship with his ex, Shaniqua Tompkins. Marquise was 6 and idolized his dad. Curtis also talked to me about his dreams and what it was like to meet his heroes. We talked about my friend Tupac, who put me in one of his videos. And he talked about Biggie singing, "Watch Me Set It Off Like Vivica" in What's Beef. I saw he was a truly gifted artist. Yes, there was 11 years between us, but at 28, he seemed to have the same work ethic I do. We got each other. I told my friend Lita Richardson, I found a worker bee like me. One time I asked him if touring made him miss things. Did he ever want to just go home? "To what?" he said. "I worked so hard to get out of Queens. But you know what I'd like?" "What?" "We got to figure out when you can come see me." We did. He invited me to his show in Atlanta. "Bring a friend," he said. "I don't want you to have to come alone." So it was me and my girl Terry Cristiano, who also did my hair and makeup. He flew us on a red eye, first class, of course. Everything was always first class with Curtis. When I got to the airport, a limo waited to take me to the hotel. It felt like we were going to a premiere. As we started driving, the driver lowered the partition. "I'll be on standby for you during your stay, Miss Fox. Anywhere you want to go, I'll take you." When the driver raised the partition, my friend Terry gave me a look. "Okay," she said. "I see 50 Cent is coming with his A-game." Truth be told, I was playing it cool for my friend, acting like I didn't care. Curtis was going all out courting me, and I had never been wooed like this before. Never. Once I was in my hotel room, I kept standing up and sitting down, knowing he was coming to see me any minute. We'd only ever talked on the phone. What if it was awkward in person? What if his breath reeked? Please, God, no. Or what if he had some idea of Vivica Fox that was not me? When he knocked on the door, I slipped into actress confidence. It's a bluffing trick you can use when you're nervous. I walked over and full Elizabeth Taylor grace, opened the door, and lifted my head to look him in the eye. And I melted. Bluff over. Curtis has the most beautiful eyes. You think the devil's ugly? Uh-uh. The devil is fine, and that's how he gets you. Curtis was 6 foot, wearing a do-rag under his Yankees cap, and what I later found out was his best jersey. He was at the height of his career, all muscle and smile. He hugged me, and I just kind of fell into his incredible body. I looked up, and he kissed me. I was knocked out. TKO. I think I lay in bed with him the whole damn day, tracing my finger along the tattoos on his back, reading Southside and 50. He teased me about the little fox tat on my left arm, which I got at Shamrock Social Club on Sunset when I was 30. I was born a fox, I told him. I'm gonna die a fox. That's my reminder. We could talk about anything on the phone, and I was relieved that connection continued in real life. He was the nicest guy, just so sweet. He shared how long he had wanted for all this to be happening to him, and it was happening. As we talked in bed, I could also see scars from when he was shot 9 times. The story went that he was in a car outside his grandmother's house when a guy snuck up and shot him point blank. His hip, his calf, his hand, his pretty face. The story was part of his PR blitz, so of course I knew about it. He still had a bit of shrapnel trapped on the left side of his tongue, which changed his voice. But something told me he didn't want to talk about it, and in the coming months I would see how much fear he still lived with. Security was a constant concern of his. He had a bulletproof Suburban with a driver trained in defensive tactics. And he always seemed to have about 6 bodyguards hanging around in public and at least 1 guy outside his hotel room. So naturally, that night he arranged a police escort to take us to the show. He put Terry and me in this little VIP area, and I noticed people clocking me like, "What is she doing here?" But this was before social media and people tweeting, "Vivica Fox is in the next stall." When he first came out on stage, his big entrance was jumping off this New York skyline set they made. And he kind of tripped up on the landing. Ooh. But I screamed like any fangirl wanting to cheer him on. By then, I knew the words to his rhymes and spat out the lines right along with him. Afterward, he was like, "I can't believe I slipped." I guess I made him nervous. We had amazing chemistry, like fireworks going off in the room, absolutely. We were connected. When I left him after the concert, we went back to talking nonstop on the phone. One day in August, he said, "Hey, will you go to the MTV Awards with me?" It felt like he was asking me to the prom. He even sounded nervous. "Of course I will," I said. This would be our public debut as a couple, and I knew I had to bring it. Let me tell you the story of the dress. I have been doing a lot of work with Randy Rahm, a fun, gifted designer from New York who believes in collaboration. When I created looks with her, I felt heard, but she also brought her own wow factor to the game. I told Randy I needed a look and confided that I had a feeling it would get a lot of attention because of Curtis. "Please let me do this for you, Vivica," Randy said. "I want it to be special." I put myself in her hands. Curtis and I decided we wanted to match colors. It really was like prom. And we decided on gray. I like to dress to a theme, so I told Randy I wanted something, you know, kind of rock and roll and definitely edgy. I watched her brain work and could see genius take fire. I like Randy because she's a hustler. Game recognizes game, right? She's a self-made, self-taught mom who at the time was just breaking into designing for celebrities. She sketched out a thigh-high mini with sort of gladiator straps just covering my breasts. The drawing made me look like a superhero. When I tried it on for the first fitting, I turned to check out my look in a full-length mirror. "Hell yeah, bitch," I said. "You look good." Curtis knew that Randy and I were planning to knock it out of the park, and he wanted to keep up. "What do you want me to wear?" he asked. Would you mind wearing a suit? I asked. I just thought he would look so handsome in a nice suit. Not at all. I love wearing a suit, he said. What about a hat? Is a hat too much? Go for it, baby, I said. In late August, I made the trip for the MTV Awards. Curtis flew me, Terry, and my go-to girl, Lita, to New York and put us up at the Four Seasons Hotel. It was another red eye, and when we got to the hotel that morning, Terry kept asking me a ton of questions. She continually stopped me from walking, asking me all this logistical stuff. It was getting on my goddamn nerves. From the lobby, up to the elevator, up to our floor, she kept yammering to me when all I wanted to do was get to my suite. We exited the elevator and turned the corner. Just as I was about to tell her ass to stop already, I saw the first rose petal, and another, and another. When I opened the door to my suite, there was a river of rose petals leading back to the bedroom. There were dozens of bouquets on every table and nightstand, every available surface. Roses by the bathtub, in the bathtub, and around the bed. I'd never seen so many in my life. Yeah, said Terry sheepishly. I was talking so much to stall you. Wanted to surprise you. Ding dong. It was Curtis at the door. I just ran and jumped into his arms. He was so romantic and so charming. And the relationship was still our secret. The following day, he asked, where do you want to have dinner tonight? Maybe Mr. Chow's? I knew it was nearby, and it had an old-world classic ambiance. It's a Chinese restaurant with lacquered black and white surfaces and pops of red, old-school waiters in white tuxedos that make you think of Scarface and mafia movies. I knew Curtis loved those films, so I thought he would like to have dinner there. The gangster and his showgirl. Yeah, baby, it was on. It was about four blocks from the hotel, and I thought we'd just walk there. But that wasn't Curtis. He needed to be driven in his bulletproof car, nicer than the one I was in earlier. I got in the back with him, and there were all these cameras. Foolish me, I thought they were TVs. They were for security, despite all the bodyguards I'd seen. That was the first time that I kind of thought, oh, man, I got to be on my P's and Q's with this guy. So when he arranged for us to have dinner in a private room at Mr. Chow's, it was in a way romantic. But it was also for his sense of protection. When he took me out, he would often shut down restaurants for our dinners or get a secret room with security always nearby. Curtis didn't like the food at Mr. Chow's. He was more of a cheeseburger and french fries type of dude than a popstickers and Beijing duck kind of guy. But he found out all my favorite dishes, and they just kept coming. Near the end of the meal, this waiter walks in with a huge covered silver platter. Curtis, I can't eat anymore, I said. Hold on, he said. I have a surprise for you. As the waiter lifted the lid, there was a platinum Rolex watch for me. Curtis took it and placed it on my left wrist. Wait, he wasn't done. When the car took us back to the hotel, three horse and carriage buggies were waiting outside the Four Seasons. We got in the middle carriage, and security flanked us in the front and back carriages. He took me around Central Park, and we talked more about our dreams. We knew by this time, the next night, everyone would know about us. You were my dream girl, you know, he said. Really? Yep, he said. I used to watch Two Can Play That Game and set it off all the time. I mean, all the time. So much so that when his baby mama, Shaniqua, came home and found him watching the TV, she would say, are you watching that damn Vivica Fox again? She laughed at me, he said. She told me, a girl like that would never be attracted to you. Keep dreaming. Oh, God. But I was so attracted to him. I've always wanted to be in a power couple, he said, like Puffy and J-Lo or Will and Jada. I put my head on his shoulder. Curtis was going to let me be me, I thought. Here was a man who wanted a union of equals. I wasn't going to be just some trophy at his disposal. God, I was so naive. The day of the MTV Awards, Randy was getting me ready in my suite at the Four Seasons. It was an amazing moment when Curtis turned the corner and saw me for the first time. "Wow," he said. "Is it all right?" "Wow," he said again. "Yeah, I look good, don't I?" The photographer sure let me know. In the pictures, I looked a little scared at first. There was this whoosh of attention as every camera fired on us. Yeah, it was our coming out moment, but I was kind of afraid it would be my coming out of my dress moment. We were brought to our seats, and Eminem was seated next to us. He leaned in and whispered to me, "God damn, you are wearing that dress," Eminem said. All the attention made me a little self-conscious. I remember Madonna was sitting right behind me, and I so wanted to turn around and say, "I freaking love you!" But I didn't, because I was thinking, "Okay, be cool, Vivica." But I damn near lost it when Beyonce performed. I was not going to play it cool and let baby girl feel anything less than adored. She came down from the ceiling, hanging by her feet, and then did a medley of Baby Boy and Crazy in Love. When Beyonce was done, I was jumping up and down so much, I can't even call it a standing ovation. Then Bay gave me a look of appreciation like, "Thanks, Vivica." The next morning, we found out we had shocked the world. Curtis and I were in bed together, flipping through between Good Morning America and the Today Show. It was news. Britney Spears, Madonna, and Christina Aguilera kissed on stage. And the other news angle was, guess who is together? That dress was everywhere. People were like, "Baby!" I called my mother and asked her what she thought of my dress. "It could have used a little bit more fabric," she said. I knew she'd say that. We were in New York a few more days, and I had a bunch of photo shoots lined up. The morning after the awards, I was shooting the cover of Today's Black Woman's magazine. It was going to take all day, and he planned to spend the time with his son. Curtis told me he couldn't wait to surprise Marquise with some clothes and sneakers. I was busy at the shoot when he hit me with a text. "Yo, she won't let me see the baby." I immediately called him. "I don't understand," I said. "What happened?" "You happened." Shaniqua was jealous, he said. He landed his dream girl. "Where are you?" he asked. "Sweetheart, I'm at my photo shoot." "Okay," he said, sounding annoyed. "Can I come see you?" Curtis came to the shoot, and I actually really liked it. Finally, he was seeing the kind of stuff I did. I was laying it on thick with my model poses, and it lightened his mood. So much so that the photographer asked if he wanted to get in a few shots. He didn't hesitate, just said, "Yeah," and got in the picture. The photographer and magazine editors told me they would only use the pictures for some inside shots. It wouldn't be the cover. And I believed them. After that, Curtis left to start a tour in Europe. I started traveling a lot for work, too, as the buzz for Kill Bill was helping me land jobs. Our schedules didn't match well for the level of phone calls he and I were used to. And frankly, he would often forget my schedule even after I sent him an itinerary. One time, I had a long flight, and he called me about 10 or 12 times while I was in the air. When I landed, I saw I had all these messages and panicked that something was wrong. By then, his concerns for his safety were my concerns, and I was worried someone had tried to hurt him. Curtis' voice messages started, "Hey, baby, I love you," and quickly devolved into, "Why are you ignoring me? And call me back." In the last message, he simply said, "Fuck off. I'm not calling you until the tour is over." Here's the thing. Part of being a ride-or-die chick is that I take direction well. If a man tells me he doesn't want me on his team, I'm out. So I was out. If he called me and apologized, that was one thing, but I wasn't going to beg someone to be with me. A few days later, I got a call from a number I didn't know. I picked up, thinking it might be for a job. It was, just not a job I wanted. "Please talk to him, Vivica." It was James, his assistant. "He won't talk to nobody," James said. "He won't eat." So I talked to him. I thought that's what I was supposed to do. He got on the phone and put on his tough voice. "Yo, what's up?" "Sweetheart, what is the matter?" I asked. "Why were you ignoring me?" Because I was on a plane, I yelled. I told you. Oh, snap! I'm sorry. It is embarrassing how many times we did this dance. Curtis would misunderstand something, usually involving my work, and he would announce that I was trying to break up with him. I often felt like I was walking on eggshells and had to go out of my way to be super supportive. Inevitably, he would invent some fight, stop talking to me, and then someone from his team would call me. I felt like I worked for them. And I know the rap group he formed, G-Unit, deeply resented me distracting Curtis and distracting attention from them. I watched some MTV interview with the whole group, and the reporter quickly asked Curtis about me. I saw one of the members, I won't name him, roll his eyes in the background like, this bitch again? Long distance wasn't working, so I was really touched when he invited me to come to Europe to attend the World Music Awards in Monaco. It's this amazing event hosted by Albert II, Prince of Monaco. Curtis was set to win Best New Artist, and yet he wanted me to be a part of it. It was really touching to me because he knew I was hurt that I was not invited to any premieres on the Kill Bill publicity leg in Europe. This will be your European tour, he said. One of the producers of the event found out I was coming and reached out to me. Hey, we hear you're going to be attending, he said. And one of our hosts has canceled. We were wondering if you would like to host the show. Mariah Carey was coming, and so was Pink. They wanted it to be special. Okay, now, if you're in the audience in this horror movie, this is the moment I need you to yell at the screen. Don't do it, Vivica! Don't do it! But I said yes. This is what Angie from Indy was thinking, I swear. This is great, because now he won't have to pay for my flight. I thought I was being a good girlfriend, saving him money. This is what a power couple does, I said to myself. Say it again, and louder, so I can hear you all the way back in time. Don't do it, Vivica! What I failed to realize was that Curtis wanted this to be his night. Later, I would realize I was insulting his manhood by standing equal with him. Monaco is one of the most beautiful places in the world, especially in October. It's a gorgeous little place set on cliffs looking over the Mediterranean. And when the temperature drops to the 60s at night, men lend their tuxedo jackets to women in gowns. It is like a film set on old Hollywood. The roads are winding and glamorous, the same ones that Monaco's Hollywood princess, Grace Kelly, drove with Cary Grant in To Catch a Thief. There I was in the city of romance, and Curtis wouldn't even talk to me. We didn't even share a room. I did what I always do when I needed help. I called my father. At first, I pretended I was just calling to let him know that I had landed safely, but then I got real. Dad, Curtis won't talk to me, I said. I don't even know where he's at. Dad diagnosed the problem right away, more than 4,000 miles away in Indiana. Evidently, he wanted to do this for you, Angie, he said. This is his night, and you were supposed to be his guest, not the host. Dad, I thought it would make him happy, I said. You can't charge right in there, baby. Don't always be doing. Sometimes you got to be done for. I closed my eyes and said an empty, I know. I looked out the window and sighed. Daddy, I'm in Monaco, I said, starting to cry. I'm supposed to be happy, and I'm not. Just play it cool, he said. He'll come around. Dad was right. Curtis finally spoke to me. Even that seemed like a miracle. We made plans to meet in my hotel room. And then I made everything 1,000 times worse by trying to do an over-the-top gesture for him. I had my room filled with roses, the same way he had done for me at the Four Seasons. When he walked in, he scanned the room and his face hardened into a sneer. Are you trying to compete with me? What? I said, honestly blindsided that he could think that. I'm your partner. I wanted to do for you what you did for me. Forget it. Forget it. That was his thanks. But I'm a trooper. I did that whole award show, and I will tell you that I nailed it. When the show was over, there was so much energy backstage, with people high-fiving and yelling, "That was great!" Curtis and I just looked at each other, no words. I went to my dressing room and sat on a couch, leaning my head back. I was still in the white Randy Rom-fitted pantsuit I wore on stage. People had been around me all night, fussing over my hair and face. And here I was alone. I could stop smiling. I felt him come in the dressing room. Before I even opened my eyes, I knew it was Curtis. He sat across from me on the couch, and we stared at each other for a little while. There had been so many times we had just looked into each other's eyes, but this time, I didn't have a single clue what he was about to say. "You did good," he said. "Thank you," I said. "It wasn't worth losing you." "You didn't lose me," he said. Honestly, at that point, I was so afraid to say the wrong thing that I silenced myself. Here's what I wanted to say. "If this mattered to you so much, why didn't you tell me? Why do I have to guess about what I actually did wrong when you're already so ready to accuse me of something I didn't do?" Instead, I hugged him and we kissed. I decided that if I did just as little as possible to set him off, he would stay the Curtis I know. We had one more night in Monaco. A bunch of us went to a restaurant, and Curtis was actually fun again. I thought, we're back on track. Later that night, we were in bed, and I kissed him. He pulled back and kind of put his lips in that little boy pout position that always signaled trouble. "You'll never love me like I love you," he said. "What are you talking about?" "I like you more than you like me." He left the next morning, and I didn't know he was keeping a secret from me. I later found out that he had planned to propose to me on that trip to Monaco. Curtis changed his mind after I took the hosting gig. His plan was to rent out a theater in Monaco and show a print he had obtained of Kill Bill. We were going to watch it, and at the end, he was going to ask me to marry him. He had a 12-carat diamond engagement ring. I didn't know any of this until about a year later. Instead of giving me the ring, he had the diamond broken in two. He wore them as earrings. He had the ring. When I found that out, it broke my heart all over again. When we left Monaco, I had no idea what might have been. I came back to America and I started working on the salon in Baltimore. I thought everything was fine, or at least as fine as I was now used to. Then that issue of Today's Black Woman came out with the huge photo of us on the cover. I had been promised the image of Curtis and me would just be inside and not on the cover. The story was all about me with him looking like a plus one. I knew he wouldn't be happy. I called him right away and left a message saying I didn't know this was going to happen. The next thing I know, my stylist friend Daryl Brown called me. "Yo, your boy's on the radio blasting you." "Who?" 50. He was going on a rant, that was it. It was the beginning of him telling the world I was a fucking bitch. "She used me," he said. He was repeating the words of his boys, who had always been trying to convince him that he was whipped. "She used you for fame. You're on the cover of a girl's magazine. You're a pussy. You're a wimp." It was their way of getting me back for every time a reporter whooshed by them at an event to ask 50, "What's it like to date a movie star?" And for the Rolex I got that they thought they deserved. Instead of Curtis coming to me and us attacking this as a couple, I became the enemy of 50 Cent. He got such a reaction out of the first radio interview that it was like he was on the Stomp Vivica tour. He was on the radio daily assassinating my character. The awful thing was that I was a feel-bad girl working on a feel-good dramedy. The salon is about a smart hairdresser who owns her own place, but a big corporate company wants to buy up the neighborhood. I'd taken it because I wanted to be in a black ensemble film with a strong female lead who could take care of business and herself. And every day I was crying, all the damn time. I started crying in the makeup chair, and they would have to start doing my makeup again. I lost 10 pounds because I was too sad to even eat. I look at that movie, and I see I was gaunt. Kim Whitley was on the movie, and every day she would knock on my trailer and check on me. She's so funny and so kind. She told me to stay strong. He's just mad because he's in love with you. Really? Because this just seemed like some Dr. Jekyll two-faced garbage. He started to up the ante, changing his tune, saying I was stalking him. I was in Baltimore making a movie. I wasn't in his freaking bushes. And then something in me said, push through, push through. He stayed away and gradually stopped talking about me. Then I was in Vancouver working on a guest thing for a show. They put me up in a hotel, and while I was there, I decided to get a facial at the hotel spa. The facialist worked my pores and even did the cucumber slice thing on the eyes. I was so relaxed. She left for a moment and then came back in. Miss Fox, you have a visitor. Who, I asked. Who would even know I was here? 50 Cent is here. I took off one cucumber slice to look at her and see if this was some kind of joke. He came in here asking for you. You're really not kidding, I said. Would you like him to leave? I paused. No, I said. It's time for us to talk. He made us promise not to tell you, she said, with the tiniest bit of fear in her voice. Can you please act surprised when you walk out? Even she thought this was crazy. Well, I never got dressed so slowly. I wanted to make him wait, and maybe a small part of me hoped he'd give up and leave. Finally, I went into the waiting room, and there he sat, leaning forward in his chair. I stared at him for a long time, a whole range of emotions coming over me. Love, hatred, that feeling of betrayal, but mainly love. Damn it, I thought. You still love him. Meanwhile, he began to stand. His face slowly changed to, oh, damn, what's she going to do? I walked right over and hugged him. Why did you leave? I asked quietly. Why did you leave? Oh, my God, why? Let's just go somewhere private, he said. He was courteous again. That voice I'd miss. What room are you in? I took him upstairs and we hung out. I ordered room service and got him his favorite, cheeseburger and fries. We turned on the TV and watched football, like nothing had ever happened. And as Curtis stared at the screen, he was able to open up without looking at me. He told me how much pressure he was under and how hard it was to date someone famous. He said his guy said dating me made him look soft. An image was everything in the rap game. He was sorry, and I accepted it. I thought that was being a strong woman. You talked all that shit about me, and now you're sorry? Look how strong I am. Look how loyal I am. Look what I am capable of being for you. I know now that people do this all the time. You get with someone so toxic that loving them is a test of your strength, and you will not allow yourself to fail. You think it's strong to hang in, but that's just what you tell yourself so you don't lose the person you love. I say I know this now because I sure as heck didn't know it then. I just thought I'll follow his lead. So he started his disappearing act. There were moments like the Vancouver spa. He'd show up at my house, waiting for me to come home. I'd walk in to find him in my living room playing with my cat Snooki. Finally, I just asked him, what's going on? I just got to figure out how to handle this, he said. I want to be with you. But he didn't. If he meant it, he would have stood up to his silly friends with their no girls allowed rules. I never told anybody about this, about all the times that he would show up. I never betrayed that confidence because I was still in love with him. In 2009, he asked me to be in his video for Do You Think About Me? He told me he wanted to shock the world again, like we did at the MTV Awards. He wanted it to be majorly cinematic with a whole storyline. There were two female roles in the video. One was the new girl, and the other was the character of the psycho ex, slashing tires, going crazy in front of the mirror. He thought it would be funny if I played the new girl. And fool me said, I'll do this for you because I care about you, and I know it will get more attention for you if I play the crazy chick. He paid me $25,000 to do the video, flew me to New York, and gave me a huge trailer. He greeted me in my trailer and thanked me. "You know you're my first wife," he said. "We just never actually got married." My friend Tamala Jones from Two Can Play That Game played his new love interest, and she told me that Curtis spent the whole time saying he had done me wrong and he loved me. She told this to me